Hello, this is Jerry reading the medical news. Prostate cancer is not a death knell, study shows, from the University of Washington. Prostate cancer statistics can look scary. 34,250 United States deaths in 2024, 1.4 million new cases worldwide in 2022. Dr. Bruce Montgomery, a University of Washington medicine oncologist, hopes that patients won't see these numbers and just throw up their hands in fear or resignation. Being diagnosed with prostate cancer is not a death knell, said Montgomery, senior author of a literature and trial review that appeared in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Montgomery is the clinical director of genitourinary oncology at Fred Hutch Cancer Center and the University of Washington Medical Center, and a professor of medicine and urology at the University of Washington School of Medicine. He encourages patients to ask their primary care doctor specific questions about this cancer, too. Montgomery also encourages his fellow doctors to bring up the question of prostate cancer screening with their patients. Knowing whether there is prostate cancer and how risky it is can be the first step. Not every cancer needs to be treated, he said. Sometimes it's safe to just watch and use active surveillance. In a 2024 study co-authored by University of Washington Medicine urologist Dr. Daniel Lin showed that active surveillance can be extremely safe. 0.1% of men who opted for surveillance died of prostate cancer after 10 years. We need to realize that prostate cancer is not one disease, Montgomery said. As a provider, you need to personalize your approach to the patient you're seeing and to the disease that they personally are dealing with. For example, if a 50-year-old man develops prostate cancer that is only in the prostate, then more aggressive measures may need to be considered. However, if the disease, which can be slow-moving, develops in an 80-year-old patient, the discussion may be quite different. I've seen men that age, that is, in the 80s, develop prostate cancer, and they've opted for no therapy, he said. They know that treatments such as radiation might make them feel terrible, so they just say no. You, as their physician, he noted, must respect that. But if you're 50 and have 25 to 30 years in which prostate cancer can become a bigger issue, even with the downsides, most patients should get therapy, he said. For more advanced prostate cancer, the number of effective treatments developed has markedly increased, as has the survival rate of men whose prostate cancer has spread to other parts of their body. Metastatic prostate cancer needs therapy, and research over the past 10 to 20 years has improved and continues to improve survival substantially, he said. Knowing who needs treatment, which treatment to use, and when is both an art and a science. Here are some facts that men and their doctors should know. Approximately 1.5 million new cases of prostate cancer are diagnosed annually worldwide. Approximately 75% of cases are first detected when the cancer is still located and localized to the prostate. This early detection was associated with a 5-year survival rate of nearly 100%. Management includes active surveillance, prostatectomy, which is the surgical removal of the prostate, or radiation therapy, depending on the risk of progression. Approximately 10% of cases are diagnosed after the cancer has spread. This stage of prostate cancer has a 5-year survival rate of 37%. The most common prostate cancer is adenocarcinoma, a type that starts in the gland cells, and the median age at diagnosis is 67 years. More than 50% of prostate cancer risk is attributable to genetic factors and older age. Prostate cancer came to public attention, both nationally and internationally, last year when famed local travel writer Rick Steves announced he had developed prostate cancer. He proclaimed last month via his X account, formerly Twitter, that after radiation and surgery, at University of Washington Medicine in Fred Hutch, he was cancer-free. Closing biological age gap could reduce stroke risk and support brain health, from Medical News Today. A biological age gap is the difference between a person's chronological age based on their birthday and their body's biological age. Biological age might age faster than a person's chronological age for several reasons, including having chronic conditions like diabetes or stress, or unhealthy lifestyle factors such as smoking, leading a sedentary lifestyle, and eating an unhealthy dietary plan. However, people can improve their biological age gap, through making healthy lifestyle choices. A new study recently presented at the American Academy of Neurology's 78th annual meeting found that improving that gap may also lower stroke risk and provide better brain health. As this is an abstract presented at a meeting, the results of the study have yet to be published in a peer-reviewed scientific journal. For this study, researchers analyzed health data for more than 258,000 people and measured 18 health-related biomarkers, including cholesterol levels and red blood cell volume, along with brain scans to determine each patient's biological age. They also recalculated biological age for roughly 6,000 participants during a follow-up visit. Chronological age is the number of years you've been alive, was explained to Medical News Today. Biological age reflects how old your body actually functions. We can estimate biological age from routine blood tests most people get, like cholesterol and blood cell counts. The gap is simply the difference between the two. Some people's bodies are aging faster than their calendar age suggests, meaning their gap is positive, while others are aging more slowly. Rivera, an instructor in the Department of Neurology at Yale School of Medicine, said they decided to look at how a person's biological age gap might impact their brain health and stroke risk, because faster biological aging has been linked to poor health outcomes broadly, but its relationship to the brain specifically was underexplored. And the more interesting question to us was not just whether the gap mattered, we already knew it did, but whether changes in that gap over time predict what happens to the brain years later, he added. That felt like a more actionable question, because it implies biological aging might be something we can modify to improve our brain health and reduce the risk of cognitive decline, stroke, and dementia. At the start of the study, participants had an average chronological age of 56 and an average biological age of 54. 6 years later, study participants had an average chronological age of 62 and an average biological age of 58. Researchers found that participants who improved their biological age gap between the start of the study and the repeat assessment had a 23% lower risk of having a stroke during the follow-up period. The important point here is that we're looking at change over time, not just a snapshot. It is not simply that biologically younger people have fewer strokes. It is that people who moved in the right direction over time and improved their biological age gap had meaningfully better outcomes a decade later. Additionally, scientists found participants with an improved biological age gap also experienced a lower volume of white matter hyperintensities, a sign of white matter tissue damage, which can lead to memory problems and cognitive decline. Overall, the total volume of damage was 13% lower for each standard deviation in improvement for these participants. White matter hyperintensities are spots visible on brain MRI that reflect damage to the brain's white matter, Riviere explained. They accumulate silently over years and are strongly linked to stroke and cognitive decline. Finding that people who improve their biological age gap had 13% less of this damage per standard deviation of improvement tells us the benefit isn't limited to stroke risk. It also extends to the structural integrity of the brain itself. That is important because this kind of tissue-level damage often precedes symptoms by years. Detecting a difference at the imaging level suggests we may be capturing something early and meaningful. Medical News Today had the opportunity to speak with John Hanna, MD, a vascular neurologist at the Comprehensive Stroke Center at Atlantic Health Overlook Medical Center in New Jersey, about the study. And he commented that the findings are plausible and consistent with likely what we already know, that individuals with better cardiometabolic health have a lower stroke risk. However, this is observational data, Hanna continued. The biological age metric is largely built from vascular and inflammatory markers, so the study could be capturing improved vascular risk control rather than proving that modifying biological aging itself reduces stroke incidence. Stroke has currently moved up to be the fourth cause of death in the United States and a leading cause of disability, he explained. Search for better tools to quantify physiological aging can assist in personalized prevention strategies and risk reduction. This will allow the clinician to intervene sooner and with more precise targeted strategies. Next steps for this research would include randomized clinical trials testing targeted interventions that reduce the biological/chronological age gap to determine whether this leads to a true causal reduction in stroke risk and markers of small vessel disease on MRI, Hanna added. Medical News Today also spoke with Trung Trinh, MD, internist for Memorial Care Medical Group and chief medical officer of the Healthy Brain Clinic in Irvine, California, who said he found the results to be both encouraging and motivating. Encouraging because we saw a consistent link between improving a person's biological age gap over time and better brain-related outcomes, like lower stroke risk and more favorable brain imaging markers, Trinh detailed. Motivating because it reinforces how closely brain health is tied to whole body health, and it gives us a measurable signal we can study more deeply. At the same time, it is important to emphasize this is an association. This study does not prove that changing biological age directly prevents stroke. For readers who may want to work on lowering the gap between their chronological and biological ages to potentially help preserve brain health and lower their stroke risk, Trinh said many of the factors that influence stroke risk and overall cardiometabolic health are also the kinds of factors that are often linked to healthier aging markets. Be physically active in a way that is safe and sustainable. Regular movement tends to benefit vascular health, mood, and sleep. Do not smoke and avoid secondhand smoke. If you do smoke, get support to quit. Eat in a heart-healthy pattern, for example, emphasizing vegetables, fruits, and legumes, whole grains, nuts, and fish, and limiting ultra-processed foods and excess added sugars. Keep blood sugar and cholesterol in healthy ranges, and follow treatment plans if you have diabetes or high cholesterol. Know and manage blood pressure, one of the biggest drivers of stroke risk. Limit alcohol and avoid binge drinking. Maintain a healthy weight and waist circumference, if recommended by your clinician, especially through nutrition, activity, and sleep, rather than quick fixes. Prioritize sleep and address sleep apnea or chronic insomnia, which can affect vascular and brain health. Stay socially and cognitively engaged, and treat hearing loss and depression. These don't replace vascular risk control, but they matter for brain health. Study strengthens link between shingles vaccine and lower dementia risk. From Stanford Medical. An unusual public health policy in Wales may have produced the strongest evidence yet that a vaccine can reduce the risk of dementia. In a new study led by Stanford Medicine, researchers analyzing the health records of Welsh older adults discovered that those who received the shingles vaccine were 20% less likely to develop dementia over the next 7 years than those who did not receive the vaccine. The remarkable findings, published in Nature, support an emerging theory that viruses that affect the nervous system can increase the risk of dementia. If further confirmed, the new findings suggest that a preventive intervention for dementia is already close at hand. Shingles, a viral infection that produces a painful rash, is caused by the same virus that causes chickenpox, varicella zoster. After people contract chickenpox, usually in childhood, the virus stays dormant in the nerve cells for life. In people who are older who have a weakened immune system, the dormant virus can reactivate and cause shingles. Dementia affects more than 55 million people worldwide, with an estimated 10 million new cases every year. Decades of dementia research has largely focused on the accumulation of plaques and tangles in the brains of people with Alzheimer's, the most common form of dementia. But with no breakthroughs in prevention or treatment, some researchers are exploring other avenues, including the role of certain viral infections. Previous studies based on health records have linked the shingles vaccine with lower dementia rates, but they could not account for a major source of bias. People who are vaccinated also tend to be more health conscious in myriad difficult to measure ways. Behaviors such as diet and exercise, for instance, are known to influence dementia rates, but are not included in health records. All these associational studies suffer from the basic problem that people who get vaccinated have different health behaviors than people who don't, said Pascal Gelsinger, MD, PhD, Assistant Professor of Medicine, and senior author of the study. In general, they're seen as not being solid enough evidence to make any recommendations on. But 2 years ago, Gelsinger recognized a fortuitous natural experiment in the rollout of the shingles vaccine in Wales that seemed to sidestep the bias. The vaccine used at that time contained a live, attenuated, or weakened form of the virus. The vaccination program, which began September 1, 2013, specified that anyone who was 79 on that date was eligible for the vaccine for 1 year. People who were 78 would become eligible the next year for 1 year, and so on. People who were 80 or older on September 1, 2013 were out of luck. They would never become eligible for the vaccine. These rules, designed to ration the limited supply of the vaccine, also meant that the slight difference in age between 79 and 80-year-olds made all the difference in who had access to the vaccine. By comparing people who turned 80 just before September 1, 2013, with people who turned 80 just after, the researchers could isolate the effect of being eligible for the vaccine. The circumstances, well documented in the country's health records, were about as close to a randomized controlled trial as you could get without conducting one. The researchers looked at the health records of more than 280,000 older adults who were 71 to 88 years old and did not have dementia at the start of the vaccination program. They focused their analysis on those closest to either side of the eligibility threshold, comparing people who turned 80 in the week before with those who turned 80 in the week after. We know that if you take 1,000 people at random, born in 1 week, and 1,000 people at random born a week later, there shouldn't be anything different about them on average, Gelsinger said. They are similar to each other apart from this tiny difference in age. The same proportion of both groups likely would have wanted to get the vaccine, but only half, those almost 80, were allowed to by the eligibility rules. What makes the study so powerful is that it is essentially with a control group, those a little bit too old to be eligible for the vaccine, and an intervention group, those just young enough to be eligible. Over the next 7 years, the researchers compared the health outcomes of people closest in age who were eligible and ineligible to receive the vaccine. Excuse me. By factoring in actual vaccination rates, about half of the population who were eligible received the vaccine, compared to almost none of the people who were ineligible. They could derive the effects of receiving the vaccine. As expected, the vaccine reduced the occurrence over that 7-year period of shingles by about 37% for people who received the vaccine, similar to what had been found in clinical trials of the vaccine. By 2020, 1 in 8 older adults who were by then 86 and 87 had been diagnosed with dementia. But those who received the shingle vaccine were 20% less likely to develop dementia than the unvaccinated. It was a really striking finding, Gelsitter said. This huge protective signal was there, any which way you looked at the data. The scientists searched high and low for other variables that might have influenced dementia risk, but found the two groups to be indistinguishable in all characteristics. There was no difference in the level of education between the people who were eligible and ineligible, for example. Those who were eligible were not more likely to get other vaccinations or preventive treatments, nor were they less likely to be diagnosed with other common health conditions, such as diabetes, heart disease, and cancer. The only difference was the drop in dementia diagnosis. Because of the unique way in which the vaccine was rolled out, bias in the analysis is much less likely than would usually be the case. Excuse me. Nevertheless, his team analyzed the data in alternate ways, using different age ranges or looking only at deaths attributed to dementia, for example. But the link between vaccination and lower dementia rates remained. The signal in our data was so strong, so clear, and so persistent, he said. In a further finding, the study showed that protection against dementia was much more pronounced in women than in men. This could be due to sex differences in immune response or in the way dementia develops, Geltzer said. Women, on average, have higher antibody responses to vaccination, for example, and shingles is more common in women than in men. Whether the vaccine protects against dementia by revving up the immune system overall, by specifically reducing reactivations of the virus, or by some other mechanism is still unknown. Also unknown is whether a newer version of the vaccine, which contains only certain proteins from the virus and is more effective at preventing shingles, may have a similar or even greater impact on dementia. Gelsitzer hopes new findings will inspire more funding for this line of research. At least investing a subset of our resources into investigating these pathways could lead to breakthroughs in terms of treatment and prevention, he said. In the past 2 years, his team has replicated the Wales findings in health records from other countries, including England, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, that had similar rollouts of the vaccine. We just keep seeing this strong protective signal for dementia in data set after data set, he said. But Kelsinger has set his sights on a large randomized controlled trial, which would provide the strongest proof of cause and effect. Participants would be randomly assigned to receive the live attenuated vaccine or a placebo shot. It would be a very simple, pragmatic trial because we have a one-off intervention that we know is safe, he said. Gelsinger is seeking philanthropic funding for the trial, as the live attenuated vaccine is no longer manufactured by pharmaceutical companies, and such a trial might not take long to see results. He pointed to a graph of the Wales data tracking the dementia rates of those who are eligible and ineligible for the vaccine. The two curves begin to separate in about a year and a half. New insights about how bad cholesterol works in the body from the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. National Institutes of Health scientists have made a significant breakthrough in understanding how bad cholesterol, known as low-density lipoprotein cholesterol, or LDL-C, builds up in the body. The researchers were able to show for the first time how the main structural protein of LDL binds to its receptor, a process that starts the clearing of LDL from the blood, and what happens when that process gets impaired. The findings, published in Nature, further the understanding of how LDL contributes to heart disease, the world's leading cause of death, and could open the door to personalizing LDL-lowering treatments like statins to make them even more effective. LDL is one of the main drivers of cardiovascular disease, which kills one person every 33 seconds. So if you want to understand your enemy, you want to know what it looks like, said Alan Remley, MD, PhD, co-senior author on this study, who runs the Lipoprotein Metabolism Laboratory at the National Institute of Health National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. Until now, scientists have been unable to visualize the structure of LDL, specifically what happens when it links up with its receptor, a protein known as LDLR. Typically, when LDL binds to LDLR, the process of clearing LDL from the blood begins. But genetic mutations can prevent that work, causing LDL to build up in the blood and get deposited into the arteries as plaque, which can lead to atherosclerosis, a precursor for heart disease. In the new study, the researchers were able to use high-end technology to get a view of what's happening at a critical stage of that process and see LDL in a new light. LDL is enormous and varies in size, making it very complex, explained Joseph Marco Trajano, PhD, chief of the structural virology section in the Laboratory of Infectious Diseases at the National Institutes of Health National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, and co-senior author on the study. No one's ever gotten to the resolution we have. We could see so much detail and start to tease apart how it works in the body. Using advanced imaging technique called cryo-electron microscopy, the researchers were able to see the entirety of the structural protein of LDL when it bound to LDLR. Then, with artificial intelligence-driven protein prediction software, they were able to model the structure and locate the known genetic mutations that result in increased LDL. The developers of the software, who were not involved in this study, were recently awarded the 2024 Nobel Prize in Chemistry. The researchers found that many of the mutations that mapped to the location where LDL and LDL are connected were associated with an inherited condition called familial hypercholesterolemia, known as FH. FH is marked by defects in how the body uptakes LDL into its cells, and people with it have extremely high levels of LDL and can have heart attacks at a very young age. They found that FH-associated variants tend to cluster in particular regions on LDL. The study findings could open new avenues to develop targeted therapies aimed at correcting these kinds of dysfunctional interactions caused by mutations. But as importantly, the researchers said, they could also help people who do not have genetic mutations, but who have high cholesterol and are on statins, which lower LDL by increasing LDLR in cells. By knowing precisely where and how LDLR binds to LDL, the researchers say they now may be able to target those connection points to design new drugs for lowering LDL from the blood. How a poor night's sleep may trigger migraine headaches, from Medical News Today. Migraine attacks affect millions of people every year. According to the American Migraine Foundation, around 37 million people, including both adults and children, in the United States, experience these painful headaches. Migraine attacks can be quite debilitating for people who are experiencing them, and oftentimes certain triggers can contribute to these headaches occurring. Researchers in the new study took a closer look at potential migraine triggers. Their study required participants to track multiple metrics daily, which set apart the study from prior research. One of the key study findings showed that participants who perceived a reduced quality of sleep the night before had a 22% increased chance of a migraine attack the following morning. The study was published in the journal Neurology. The symptoms of migraine attacks vary from person to person. According to the National Institutes of Health, some symptoms of migraine attack include severe pain on one side of the head, as well as nausea and sensitivity to light. The attacks can last up to 3 days. While there are migraine medications, such as Topamax and Imitrex, to help prevent these headaches from occurring or lessen symptoms, they are not 100% effective. Researchers wanted to learn more about predicting and possibly preventing these attacks through tracking by mobile phone apps and electronic diaries. The study had a participant pool of 477 people, with the youngest participant being 7 years of age and the oldest participant being 84 years of age. There were 291 female participants and 186 male participants, which the study authors mentioned set in their research apart from prior work, since other studies typically have mostly female participants. The participants had to report their emotional state throughout the day in an electronic diary. The emotional states included anxiety, mood, energy, and stress. The participants also reported on both their perceived sleep quality and sleep duration with mobile apps. The participants wore actigraphy monitors, which look similar to smartwatches and measure activity, including sleep times, wake-up times, and sleep disruption. Researchers said this allowed them to see how participants' actual sleep time and sleep quality compared to how the participants perceived their sleep. Participants also reported any migraine attacks they experienced, as well as the timing of those headaches. The participants logged the information for 2 weeks. After collecting the information, the researchers performed a statistical analysis of the data. The researchers said the results showed a connection between perceived sleep quality and energy changes and an increased risk of migraine attacks. People who felt like their sleep quality was lower experienced a 22% increased chance of having migraine the following morning. However, this did not impact afternoon or evening headache chances. Compared to the sleep results shown in the actigraphy monitor, there was a discrepancy between perceived sleep quality and actual sleep quality. The researcher also found that lower energy levels the prior day increased the chances of a morning attack the following day by 16%. Conversely, people who experienced a much higher energy level than normal, combined with a higher stress level than normal, saw a 17% increased chance of migraine the next day in either the afternoon or the evening. The scientists said they did not find any connection between mood issues such as depression or anxiety levels and an increased risk of migraine. Surprisingly, we found no link between a person's anxiety and depression symptoms, either having more symptoms or having higher than average levels of symptoms, and their likelihood of having a migraine attack the next day. Overall, researchers said the study offers more insight into how sleep and energy patterns can be used to predict migraine and contribute to prevention. Tracking these patterns can give people with a history of migraine the ability to improve both self-awareness and the management of their condition. The findings highlight the role of circadian rhythms in headache. Circadian rhythms refer to the 24-hour cycle of being awake and sleeping. As noted by the Sleep Foundation, circadian rhythms dictate multiple processes in the body, including alertness, sleepiness, appetite, and body temperature. Disruption of circadian rhythms can affect how one feels throughout the day and can even contribute to memory issues. Dr. Mark Burrish, the director of Will Irvin Headache Research Center with the McGovern Medical School at the University of Texas Health Houston, who was involved in the research, spoke with Medical News Today and addressed the study in regards to circadian rhythms. Research suggests that approximately half of patients with migraine have a circadian pattern to their headaches, with the headaches occurring at about the same time each day, Burrish said. A specific gene variant in patients causes both migraine and circadian rhythm disorder called advanced sleep phase disorder, where patients go to bed and wake up much earlier than most other people. Burrish thinks that an increased understanding of how sleep factors into migraine will help with prevention. We think circadian rhythms might be important in the prevention of migraine because a circadian-related molecule called melatonin is sometimes used as a preventive treatment for migraine based on positive clinical trial data. Burrish also thinks that the improved understanding can help develop better medication and help people make behavioral changes to reduce the frequency of headaches. Aligning our eating, exercise, sleeping, and other behaviors to our individual circadian rhythm may help prevent headaches, he said. Dr. Joey Gee, a neurologist with Providence Mission Hospital in California, who was not involved in the study, also spoke with Medical News Today. There are specific patterns of headaches that may come on more frequently and intensity, depending on the sleep cycle, and this can include migraines, Gee said. For people who experience migraine, Gee emphasized the importance of sleep hygiene. It is often very important to maintain an adequate sleep schedule, commented Gee. Going to sleep when tired and getting the necessary hours to feel rested is very important in all patients with chronic headaches, specifically those with migraines and cluster headaches. The importance of this kind of study will only aid in supporting our knowledge about encouraging patients with headache disorders to improve their overall sleep behavior. Personalized blood count could lead to early intervention for common diseases. From Mass General Brigham, a complete blood count, known as a CBC, screening, is a routine exam requested by most physicians for healthy adults. This clinical test is a valuable tool for assessing a patient's overall health from one blood sample. Currently, the results of CBC tests are analyzed using a one-size-fits-all reference interval. But a new study led by researchers from Mass General Brigham suggests that this approach can lead to overlooked deviations in health. In a retrospective analysis, researchers show that these reference intervals, or set points, are unique to each patient. The study revealed that one healthy patient's CBC set points can be distinguishable from 98% of other healthy adults, and the results of this study are published in Nature. Complete blood counts are common tests, and our study suggests CBCs vary a lot from person to person, even when completely healthy. And a more personalized and precision medicine approach could give more insight into a person's health or disease, said senior author John Higgins, MD, of the Center for Systems Biology and Department of Pathology at Massachusetts General Hospital, a founding member of Mass General Brigham. The long-term stability and patient specificity of set points may provide new opportunities for the personalized management of healthy adults envisioned by precision medicine. CBC's indices are known to shift due to genetics, disease history, and age. But the new study suggests that individual patients have a set point, a stable value around which measures fluctuate. By considering CBC set points tailored to an individual, clinicians may be able to diagnose diseases in their early stages in adults that appear otherwise healthy, including disorders such as diabetes, heart disease, and kidney failure, all of which can benefit from early intervention. The study, with first author Brody H. Foy, a research fellow at the Massachusetts General Hospital, who is now a faculty member in the Department of Laboratory Medicine and Pathology at the University of Washington, found that for multiple diseases, set points produce a 2- to 4-fold relative risk stratification, which is comparable to that provided by common disease screening factors. The researchers note that these set points create new opportunities to investigate the mechanisms of varying CBC thresholds, and that the information from CBC set points could be used to create more specific treatment plans, including determining if additional screening is needed for an accurate diagnosis. New gene therapy reverses heart failure in a large animal model. From the University of Utah Health. A new gene therapy can reverse the effects of heart failure and restore heart function in a large animal model. The therapy increases the amount of blood the heart can pump and dramatically improves survival in what a paper describing the results calls an unprecedented recovery of cardiac function. Currently, heart failure is irreversible. In the absence of a heart transplant, most medical treatments aim to reduce the stress on the heart and slow the progression of the often deadly disease. But if the gene therapy shows similar results in future clinical trials, it could help heal the hearts of the 1 in 4 people alive today who will eventually develop heart failure. The researchers were focused on restoring critical heart protein called cardiac bridging integrator 1, known as CBIN1. They knew that the level of CBIN1 was lower in heart failure patients, and that the lower it was, the greater risk of severe disease. When CBIN1 is down, we know patients are not going to do well, said Robin Shaw, MD, PhD, director of the Nora Eccles Harrison Cardiovascular Research and Training Institute at the University of Utah, and a co-senior author on the study. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to say what happens when we give it back. To try and increase BIN1 levels in cases of heart failure, the scientists turned to a harmless virus commonly used in gene therapy to deliver an extra copy of the EBIN1 gene to heart cells. They injected the virus into the bloodstream of pigs with heart failure. The virus moved through the bloodstream into the heart, where it delivered the CBIN1 gene into heart cells. For this heart failure model, heart failure generally leads to death in a few months. But all 4 pigs that received the gene therapy in their heart cells survived for 6 months, the endpoint of the study. Importantly, the treatment didn't just prevent heart failure from worsening. Some key measures of heart function actually improved, suggesting the damaged heart was repairing itself. Shaw emphasizes that this kind of reversal of existing damage is highly unusual. In the history of heart failure research, we have not seen efficacy like this, Shaw says. Previous attempted therapies for heart failure have shown improvements to heart function on the order of 5 to 10%. EBIN1 gene therapy improved function by 30%. It's night and day, Shaw adds. The treated heart's efficiency at pumping blood, which is the main measure of the severity of heart failure, increased over time, not to fully healthy levels, but to close to that of healthy hearts. The hearts also stayed less dilated and less thinned out, closer in appearance to that of non-failing hearts. Despite that fact, throughout the trial, the gene-transferred animals experienced the same level of cardiovascular stress that had led to their heart failure. The treatment restored the amount of blood pumped per heartbeat back to entirely normal levels. Even though the animals are still facing stress on the heart to induce heart failure in animals that got the treatment, we saw recovery of heart function and that the heart also stabilizes or shrinks, said Ting-Ting Hong, MD, PhD, Associate Professor of Pharmacology and Toxicology, an investigator at the University of Utah, and co-senior author on this study. We call this reverse modeling. It's going back to what the normal heart should look like. The researchers think that CBIN1's ability to rescue heart function hinges on its position as a scaffold that interacts with many of the other proteins important to the function of the heart muscle. CBIN1 serves as a centralized signaling hub, which actually regulates multiple downstream proteins, said Jing Li, associate instructor. By organizing the rest of the heart cell, CBIN1 helps restore critical functions of heart cells. CBIN1 is bringing benefits to multiple signaling pathways, Li added. Indeed, the gene therapy seemed to improve heart function on the microscopic level, with better organized heart cells and proteins. The researchers hope that CBIN1's role as a master regulator of heart cell architecture could help CBIN1 gene therapy succeed and introduce a new paradigm of heart failure treatment that targets the heart muscle itself. Along with industry partner Tikun Lev Therapeutics, the team is currently adapting the gene therapy for use in humans and intend to apply for FDA approval for human clinical trials in the last fall. While the researchers are excited about the results so far, the therapy still has to pass toxicology testing and other safeguards. And like many gene therapies, it remains to be seen if it will work for people who have picked up a natural immunity to the virus that carries the therapy. But the researchers are optimistic. When you see large animal data that's really close to human physiology, it makes you think, Hong said. This human disease, which affects more than 6 million Americans, maybe this is something we can cure. Sandalwood oil byproduct prevents prostate cancer development in mice, from Florida Atlantic University. Extracted from the core of sandalwood trees, sandalwood oil has been used for many centuries by several cultures throughout the world for perfumes, soaps, incense, and candles. With its earthy, sweet scent, this essential oil also is used in the food industry and topically in various cosmetic preparations. Importantly, this natural oil is known for its health benefits and medicinal applications, from antibacterial to anti-cancer, because of its phytochemical constituents. In addition to containing esters, free acids, aldehydes, ketones, and santonin, sandalwood oil primarily, 90% or more of it, constitutes santalol, equal amounts of two compounds, alpha and beta santalol. Now researchers from Florida Atlantic's University Schmidt College of Medicine and collaborators are the first to demonstrate in vivo the chemopreventative properties of alpha santalol against prostate cancer development using a transgenic mouse model. Results of the study published in the journal Phytomedicine Plus showed that administration of alpha santalol decreased the incidence of prostate tumors by decreasing cell proliferation and inducing apoptosis without causing weight loss or any noticeable side effects. Apoptosis, or programmed cell death, is a method the body uses to get rid of unneeded or abnormal cells such as cancer cells. Findings reveal that the area occupied by normal tissue in alpha santalol treated mice was 53% compared to 12% in control mice. This suggests that administering alpha santalol protected the normal tissue and delayed progression from prosthetic intraepithelial neoplasia, a precancerous condition, to poorly differentiated carcinoma, a high-grade form of cancer where cancer cells and tissues look very abnormal. These results are significant because mortality in prostate cancer patients is mainly attributed to advanced stages of the disease. In prior studies, the researchers demonstrated the efficacy of alpha santalol in suppressing growth and inducing apoptotic cell death in cultured human prostate cancer cells. Based on these observations, They selected a genetically engineered mouse model that resembles many features similar to human prostate cancer, eliciting different lesion grades and cancer progression. Although our cellular studies provided important mechanistic insights, relevant in vivo models are vital for developing novel chemopreventive agents for clinical use and to determine if alpha-santolol offers protection against prostate cancer development, said A.J. Bamaridi, Ph.D., senior author and associate professor of pharmacology in the Department of Biomedical Center Science, Florida Atlantic University, Schmidt College of Medicine. Prior to this new study, alpha-santolol's in vivo efficacy against prostate cancer development had not yet been established. Additional findings of the current study showed alpha-santolol reduced the incidence of visible prostate tumors compared to control-treated mice. Only 11% in the treated group developed prostate tumors, whereas more than half in the control group developed the tumors. The differences in urogenital and prostate weights were statistically significantly different in alpha-santolol-treated mice compared with controls. The average wet weight of urogenital tract in alpha-santolol-treated mice was about 74.28% lower compared with control mice. Similarly, the average wet weight of the prostate gland was lower by 52.9% compared with controlled mice. Prostate cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death in men in the United States. An estimated 288,300 new cases were diagnosed in American men last year, with about 34,700 estimated deaths. Current treatment methods for prostate cancer include androgen ablation, chemotherapy, radiotherapy, and radical prostatectomy, but are ineffective against advanced prostate cancers. Early detection and local therapy have resulted in improved outcomes, but has been challenging with the management of advanced stages. Identifying agents that have the ability to selectively target cancerous cells and delay onset and progression of prostate cancer is greatly needed. Additional studies are essential to systemically explore the feasibility of alpha-santolol as a promising chemopreventive and anti-tumor agent against human prostate cancer development, and to elucidate the mechanisms surrounding the role of apoptotic proteins. Just 24 minutes of specially designed music could significantly reduce anxiety. From Toronto Metropolitan University, a new randomized clinical trial suggests that listening to specially designed music for just 24 minutes may significantly lower anxiety. The music was paired with auditory beat stimulation, ABS, a technique that uses rhythmic sound patterns to influence brain activity. Researchers say the approach could provide an accessible drug-free option for people looking for additional ways to manage stress and regulate emotions. The clinical trial was conducted by psychology researchers Danielle K. Mullen and Frank A. Russo at Toronto Metropolitan University in partnership with Lucid, a digital therapeutics company that emerged from Toronto Metropolitan University's Zone Learning ecosystem. Anxiety affects millions of people around the world. Common treatments include medications and cognitive behavioral therapy known as CBT. But these options can come with challenges such as side effects, long wait times, cost, and the time required for ongoing treatment. Because of these barriers, researchers have been exploring music-based digital therapeutics as a low-cost and widely accessible way to help people manage anxiety symptoms. These tools aim to quickly deliver quick relief through guided listening experiences that can be used by almost anywhere. The study included 144 adults who had moderate trait anxiety and were already taking medication to help manage their symptoms. Participants were randomly assigned to one of four listening groups. Pink noise, 24 minutes with a control. Music with auditory beat stimulation for 12 minutes. Music with auditory beat stimulation for 24 minutes. And music with auditory beat stimulation at 36 minutes. Before and after the listening sessions, participants completed standardized assessments that measured anxiety levels and mood. The results showed that listening to music with auditory beat stimulation significantly reduced both cognitive and somatic symptoms of anxiety compared with the pink noise control. Participants also reported improvements in negative mood. Among the different listening durations tested, the 24-minute session produced the strongest overall reduction in anxiety. Its effects were similar to the 36-minute session and clearly stronger than the 12-minute session. What we're seeing is a dose-response pattern where about 24 minutes of music with auditory beat stimulation seems to be the sweet spot, said Russo, professor of psychology at Toronto Metropolitan University and chief science officer of Lucid. It's long enough to meaningfully shift anxiety levels, but not so long that listeners need to carve out a large block of time. Investigating the dose-response relationship between music and anxiety reduction, a randomized clinical trial, was published in PLOS Mental Health.